This begins our eighth segment of Shaul's Ark. This is really sort of moving further away from the text. We're moving into the realm of philosophy and morality. Very difficult topic that we have to try to deal with, try to digest. We talked a little bit about, from the Mefarshim perspective, the evil nature of Amalek last time. We dwelt on some of the factors, but we didn't get through all of the evilness of Amalek, all the different tiers of Amalek, but nonetheless, what I want to do is, in the next little bit, is just to sort of dwell on some information about trying to digest it today, because it's very foreign to our senses. You know, what I'd say is, let's start at the beginning and ask the following question. Our episode is perhaps a very good starting point, as we see an interesting thing happening. We see Shaul and we see Amalek, and Shaul and Agag, and Shaul has mercy on Agag, right? So that's what we see happening. And then intercedes Shmuel, tells him he is willfully disobedient, and therefore going to suffer the consequences of that, and goes over to the prisoner who is ostensibly unarmed, and at this point in time a prisoner of war, and hews him to pieces, right? And Shmuel is seen as the hero of the story, and Shaul is seen as the criminal. Now what's fascinating about that is that's really a good starting point to say, well, if we question that, if we try to understand that, it can help us and try to understand a little more about history and what's really going on, right? If that's our example text of the problem. So what's clashing, if we kind of just sort of turn the mirror inwards with a little bit of magnification, and we look into ourselves and ask ourselves, what makes us feel so uncomfortable about this whole situation? so today, just a recap. We just try to address the issues of Amalek and our sensitivity. So if we look inside ourselves, and we ask ourselves, perhaps what is going on inside us that's so difficult? Is on the one hand, you know, we're told and we're taught and we believe that Judaism is a very moral and very merciful religion, and we're told to espouse mercy. At the same time, you know, one of the traits of being a Jew is the Gemara describes is gomle chasadim, is a person who has rachmanim b'ayshanim gomle chasadim. Rachmanim is a person who's merciful, and here you are in a case where seemingly mercy is not called upon, and it's just very hard in today's terms, especially when, you know, we're living in a world so critical of civilian casualties, so sensitive to anybody who's not you know collateral damage in any events, to understand how there could be such a command, men, women, children, animals, the whole business, and Shaul is held accountable for maybe exercising some aspect of pity or mercy. So that's where we start from. So we're gonna, like, there's a lot of questions we could ask on this, lots of ways we could look at this. The sources that we're going to deal with today, I really encourage people to have a chance to look at the full sources. Most of these are available online, most of these essays. They're really, really eye-openers. We're going to really do a quick survey. The first question is, does the Torah want us to hate in the first place? You know, like, is there ever a time to hate? Is there?
Yeah.
Where do we see hate? Right, so we do see that the Torah exercises over here. So the Torah does tell us, well, now it doesn't say necessarily hate, but it means wipe out, right? Timcheh zecher Amalek. So there is a notion of wiping them out. The question is, maybe to frame it this way. What should our sensitivities be while doing something which is, we'll call objectively, now that's a dangerous word, but something which is objectively cruel. So when the Torah asks us to do something which is cruel, so one example is Mechias Amalek, you know, but there are other examples that we can think of where the Torah asks us to do something which is jarring to the senses. So what should our emotional background be to that? If we stick a, you know, emotion scope into us, what should it be reading at that point in time? Should it be, this is great because what the Torah told me to do, or I hate doing this, but the Torah told me to do it, right? How in tandem should we be feeling with those kind of things? So, interestingly enough, one example that I remember seeing quoted is an Ir HaNidachas. An Ir HaNidachas is a city which wholeheartedly adopts the service of Avodah Zarah in Israel. Okay, so a city which completely, wholeheartedly, men, women, children adopt Avodah Zarah, and the Torah tells us that the result is, and it's very hard to get to this result, but the result is, what's the verdict for such a city? Destroy it. Everybody's killed in that city. The Gemara says in Sanhedrin that according to most opinions, it never really occurred. You could never really get to such a decrepit state of society. It really, the conditions are really astronomical. So we're told we can't really. We're told about the city. So at the end of this, this is what the Torah says. Rav Pam says in his book on the Parshios. This is a beautiful thing I remember from a number of years ago. He says, this is what the Torah tells us. V'lo yidbak b'yodcha m'umma men acherim, l'man yoshuv Hashem mechoren apoy, v'nosan l'cho rachamim v'richam cho. You shouldn't take any of the loot. You shouldn't take any of the things you found in that city. And in order that Hashem should return from his anger on this terrible edifice of people, and Hashem will give you mercy and instill in you mercy. Why does the Torah need to tell us that? Why is the Torah going out of its way to say that Hashem is going to sort of give us a booster pack of mercy? Because there are collateral effects. There are collateral effects of killing people. So what the Torah is saying over here is, default emotional, we'll call it equilibrium, is supposed to be mercy. There are actions that call upon ourselves to do things which would be devastating to mercy. And what happens? We have to do them. But then the Torah says, you know what, I'm going to make sure at the end of the day, I'm going to help supplement the mercy that you lost through the cruelty necessary for this action in the name of Hashem. That's what the psukim seem to be saying over here. So what Rav Pam is saying to us is that the Torah recognizes how much of an emotional toll it takes when the Torah calls upon us to do things which we'll call unnatural to what we're trained and to what we live up to. That's a fascinating thing. That means to say the Torah asks us to do such things, but recognizes how much it is not natural. Another example of this. This is really a very, very important Rav Hirsch. I saw it a number of years ago. I was not able to track it down until this last year when we went through Parshas Sefer Devarim again. It is so important, this Rav Hirsch. Rav Hirsch, of course, is speaking, you know, in a German, you know, enlightened society, not too different from us, even though just a few centuries ago. But he is talking now about how about the wars that the Torah mandates Israel take upon the nations in the land of Israel. And the Torah tells us unequivocally, it says, Lo yisachos encho aleihem, don't have mercy on them, right? Don't have pity on any of the inhabitants you come across. And Rav Hirsch says, how can this be? What kind of people is the Torah demanding us to become? Says the Torah, says Rav Hirsch, the repeated admonitions not to have any mercy on the Canaanite population show how much a merciless procedure goes against the grain of the Jewish people, and is against what they are meant to be, which is and is to remain the predilection to protect all living creatures. They are to regard this merciless procedures against the Canaanite population as an exception expressly commanded by God to be done at his bidding because of the special circumstances. Why is it that the Torah goes out of its way so many times to tell us how these wars operate and not leaving anybody behind and making sure you eradicate? Why, says Rav Hirsch? Because that's not your natural, that's not the default position of where our emotions are supposed to be. So this is, again, going in the same kind of direction. The default is supposed to be mercy, but there's certain times you have to go out of your way for whatever reason, in particular circumstances, in this, whether it be the establishing the land of Israel in a we'll call it monotheistic, clean environment, whether it be in Dachas, because this is going to be something which this is the antithesis of what God is in a communal setting. So these are times of the exceptions, but nonetheless, the Torah recognizes that that's the exception. It does not encourage us to adopt such characteristics and while doing them. So that's step number one. These are gems just to appreciate when we read the Torah again, and they're based directly in the Psukim, how Rav Hirsch sees the repeated admonitions or requirements to destroy the land, the people in the land, and number two is Rav Pam, who talks about the extra rachmim supplements. Okay, so that's the first question: what is our emotion supposed to be doing when we're doing something like this, when we are forced to do this? It's in a state of discord. Not everything's at ease. There's something rotten in the state of Denmark when we're doing it, but it needs to be done. And we're going to have to deal with the consequences as well that come with it. So, now, the question that the next question, we just sort of like, just if these are, I'm just throwing out a few ideas that I've come across and personally have helped me, and then we're going to get to the core issue itself. Now the question is don't we believe that all human beings are special, unique, blessed, and therefore how can we possibly ever think of anybody that we could wipe out? You know, is there a person evil enough who deserves to be killed? You know, how do we, in our arrogant way, turn around and say we can, you know, whether it be capital punishment, whether it be war, whether it be something else, how do we have the right to lay death upon another person? After all, we're all humans. Right? Is our blood redder than anybody else's? So that's that question. Is that true? What do you think? Do we have the right to do that? Do we have the right? Is it simply utilitarian? Well, it's better for society if you know, murderers and rapists and terrible people are removed from society. Is that the way we do view it? Shane, what do you think?
I was actually asking another question. I thought, how do you wipe out like everybody?
We'll get there in a second. I want to deal with individuals right now. We're going to get to the everybody in a second.
I think this comes up very much with the young Israeli soldiers who are there on the front line, and then the Arabs put their little boy in.
Yep.
We've heard stories where you hesitated because it was a child and they got shot.
Yeah. So it becomes very complicated. Unfortunately,
you asked that.
You're right. Unfortunately, that just complicates issues. I'm saying, is there ever a time that a person has essentially revoked their humanity? That's what I'm asking. Before we get to the complications.
Sure.
Right. So it's interesting. So like, it is interesting. We'll see an essay at the end by Rabbi Meir Soloveitchik, who talks about in Christianity there's a hesitance to say that somebody is ever beyond the line. In Judaism, it's actually there are many people who can cross the line. There are many lines in Judaism beyond which you've lost something. An example being, he has the Mishnah in Pirkei Avos. The Mishnah in Pirkei Avos says, Rabbi Akiva was quoted as saying, "Hoya Omer Chaviv Adam Shenivra B'Tzelem." You know, deer is a human because they're created in the Tzelem Elokim. That a Jew or a human? That is a human. That's not a Jew. The next sentence is a Jew. The next one is drop down 1 line. Chaviv Yisrael Shenikru Banim Lamakom. Israel's deer because we're considered children. So there's deer because it says Tzelem Elokim to all of humanity, and then there's dearness to Hashem because we're children. Says the Tiferes Yisrael, Rav Yisrael ben Gedalia Lipschitz, living in the early 1800s, and he's writing in Germany. He has a tremendous essay on this particular mission about the view and importance of all humanity, which is really astounding, not for now. But in the middle of this mission, he says in his perush, Chavivim Yisrael Shenikru Banim Lamakom, Shekol Ha'uma Is Chavivim Sheyesh Lahem Tzelem Elokim. All the nations have a Tzelem Elokim. They've got a part of Hashem in them. Nonetheless, Keshe Yarshiu Ma'od, when they become terribly evil, Efshar Shistalek Mehem Hatzelem, they can lose their humanity. Don't you know what that means? That means that you can have an individual who walks around, looks like a human, eats, sleeps, talks like a human, and is no longer a Tzelem Elokim. Is no longer a walking image of God anymore, because that's how far they can go. Now, this is interesting, he says, that's about Umos Ha'olam. Apparently, children don't lose that somehow. Even terrible, terrible children. That's an interesting point he's making over here. He says, "Ukamosh Kosov Chazal to also listakel b'fnei Adam Rasha." He quotes a Chazal that you're not allowed to look in the face of an evil person. He says because you're not looking in the face of God anymore. You're looking in the face of a sophisticated primate. You know, but at the end of the day, he's no longer human. Jesse.
You know, while we in theory believe that there are things that we can do that are no longer redeemable,
mm-hmm.
And for practicality's sake, you know, the Gemara talks in a lot of places about how we never really enacted in a lot of these punishments, right? Like, in theory it would happen, but it never.
Let's just clarify. There's punishments, and then there's this. Meaning, we're talking about something so extreme that a person's constantly losing it, Tzelem Elokim. Let's say we have a person who does bad things, and they have to be punished. And let's say a person even does something which deserves a capital punishment. That doesn't necessarily mean that they lose their Tzelem Elokim. That means to say that they've done something for which the only kapara is going to be via a very, very severe channel of conduct or mechanisms. But in the end of the day, we don't necessarily say that. We're talking about people who are so bad. We're talking about the Hamans and the Hitler Yimach Shemos of history, who are no longer part of humanity.
When does the build-up of bad deeds push you over?
Push it to that far. It's not. He isn't giving us any lines or distinctions. I think the right now, just the fact that is there is an important realization, because even though it sounds obvious, right? This sounds like an obvious thing, but you know, if you read this essay, we're going to get a little touch on a few points that Rabbi Soloveitchik mentions at the end. Christianity is a little more aloof from that. They wouldn't say that everybody has a place in the kingdom of heaven. And so we have to realize that, no, they're, and if you take it closer to home and you read the Rambam, based on the Mishnah at the end of Sanhedrin, as a Jew, there are things that a Jew can do, which are called kares, which means to say that there ain't no afterlife. Right? So it means to say that even as a Jew, forget, let me move away from the Tzelem Elokim argument, you can actually cut yourself off from eternity. So, and those are very specific. We know there's 24 specific cases. Judy?
What about the Ben Sora?
Very good question. So the Ben Sora...
Never was one.
Yeah, so there's a discussion, same as the Inrani Zachas, whether it happened or not, by the Ben Sora, by the wayward and rebellious child. But yeah, just to clarify that could also be, again, saving him. meaning that might not be about an announcement about his state of humanity, but it could be that it's just protecting him. The way the Gemara says it is, Yomos Zakav al Yomos Chayav, he should die innocent, not guilty, which is an astounding concept. But nonetheless, so we can have to divide up where things are actually punishments, or we'll call it, you know, pre-punishments, and actual, really, you know, a person has really lost their some aspect of this or the next world. This sounds like they've lost this world too. Like there's nothing left for these people. Nonetheless, we see this. So it's important to reckon with the fact that when we talk about people and we talk about evil, there are people who do lose. They do lose their standing as human beings. Not everybody. Now the problem is like this. It's just so you should be aware. And like, you know, just to draw another example. Yeah, this week there was a march in Manchester from a number of imams and religious leaders in Muslim community talking about that this the people who do this is not in the name of our religion, you know, which is I really to the greatest congratulations that they were able to do this. The more moderate of the lot. But in the end of the day, just to realize this, the people who are killing themselves in London and Manchester and Paris and all over the world where they're trying to kill people and in Tehran and wherever they're killing people, they are killing in the name of the same religion, right? So just to put what that means to say, they're looking in the same book and they're getting the same answers. So I want to be just very careful. When we're learning this, just as an appreciation, somebody who's fundamentally made a choice that they're going to do something terrible will look at the same things that we're looking at and say, oh, well, everybody else who's not like the way I see it has also lost their humanity. I'm going to use this as the backing to my fundamentalist view. So just to be careful, there are people throughout history who are going to take these expressions of where there's times where you have to eradicate people as their mission statement to the life they've chosen to lead before they saw the mission statement. Okay, so we need to be careful about that. At the same time, it's realizing that the Torah in an intellectually honest way has given us the space for this. Now, okay, so that's in terms of those are generalities. These are really not so helpful, as Jesse was pointing out, because this is really just talking about generally. You know, okay, so the Torah wants us to have a emotionally, you know, merciful equilibrium. That we know that people do lose that individually. Now the question is, so what do we do about our Molech? Right? So how do we swallow that? That's where it's a little more difficult. So here's how it goes. We're going to just do a few different levels of understanding. So the first, I want to help let's move through some of these ideas. We're going to move through the ideas of Rav Aaron Lichtenstein, Rav Norman Lamb. We're going to try to work through some Rav Yosef Dov Soloveitchik, and then also Rav Meir Soloveitchik, his grandson as well. So just some of their ideas as I talk about this. And if we have a chance, we might get back to the roots of where this all comes from in the first place. So that's where things become interesting. So here we go. Let's start off. This is in an essay that Rav Aaron Lichtenstein wrote a number of years ago. We just passed his second Yahrzeit. And Rav Aaron Lichtenstein says a very fascinating thing. He's talking about the Second Lebanon War. So we're talking 1982. After the war started, there was this terrible incident in which occurred where the Israelis were trying to give Lebanon over to more moderate hands, which they felt was in the hands of certain Christian groups. And those Christian groups ended up massacring Palestinian refugee camp under their watch. And it was a terrible, the whole thing was a very terrible time, which Israel still has a mark on for today, even though Israel wasn't actually active in the massacre, but they gave the keys to these groups. So he says the following. There's a third risk as well. I spoke before about accepting the problem of the Akedah, of recognizing a certain conflict here between morality and mitzvah, and of granting legitimacy to one's grappling with this issue. This too can be this too can present an educational problem. Let me illustrate with an incident which occurred to me during the Lebanon War. After the massacre at Sabra and Shatila, I published an open letter to the Prime Minister. Among other things, this letter dealt with the use of force and the motivation behind it. I asked, why was it that King Shaul was punished for not killing Agag, king of Amalek? Was it simply for not having killed the last remaining Amalekite? I suggested that he was punished not just for sparing Agag, but because the fact that he refused to kill Agag placed in a totally different light his killing over all the other Amalekites beforehand. So again, Rav Lichtenstein is actually, it's so beautiful. What he's doing is he's reading Nach as the lens to understanding what's going on in the 1980s. You understand? That's his guiding principle. So what's going on here? Why was his lack of killing Agag so bad? Shaul had been commanded to take the whole people and kill them. And this is, morally, a frightful thing. The only justification lies in being a response to an unequivocal divine command. Therefore, if Shaul had been motivated in his actions purely by fear of God, by obedience to the Tzav, then he would have followed the command to the letter. God didn't say kill Amalek, but spare Agag. Now, if he didn't kill Agag, but killed everybody else, what does that indicate? It indicates that what motivated him in killing the others was not the tzav of God, but rather some baser impulse, some instinctive violence. And the proof is that he killed everyone but spared his peer, the royal comrade. If that is the case, then Shaul was not punished for sparing Agag. Rather, he had been punished because of the Amalekites he did kill. Why? Because he killed them not purely due to a divine command, which is the only thing that can overcome the moral consideration, but rather out of military, diplomatic, or political considerations. That a fascinating insight. So the punishment of Shaul was not his mercy on Agag. It was what the mercy on Agag showed us about his motivations when killing the rest of them. Because nothing grants you the power, the will, the allowance to kill anybody else, unless God's telling you to. So if you go back to Rav Lichtenstein and say, so Rav Lichtenstein, why is it that we kill Amalek? And the answer would be solely for one purpose, because Hashem says so. Yes, I mean, you say, we have a certain moral standard, but that standard is set by God. If He gives us the mandate to do it, we have to follow that mandate, but only because He said so. The moment you sway from that, it shows you that we're not actually doing it for that. There's other principles involved. What a fascinating insight into this over here. He's not putting logic into it. He's telling us simply, this is it, and that's the only way we would ever be able to do such a thing. And by the way, just as a sense of humility, this is just important to appreciate, and we're going to get to this in a second. But this it's important to realize and appreciate that we operate within a certain bandwidth of logic, right? So, meaning God created us, and He created us with a certain ability to think and feel and sense, and He gave us five main apertures into how can we intake knowledge. Actually, there's really nine senses. Just out of interest, to think about what the other four physiological senses are. But we call it the five senses as our way of admitting information. And we have certain logical principles. We've developed them to integrate systems. And we analyze the world. You know, but in the end of the day, he created the system. He put us in the grid. So if he tells us there's something you've got to do outside of the grid, right? Meaning, who are we? You know, it's like this. It's like you for a moment close your eyes and you imagine a figure in your mind. You know, imagine, let's say, a young boy. And you can imagine, if you close your eyes and you just hold that boy in your mind, you can imagine this little avatar you've created, you know, walking down a hill from his house in a small hilltop village. And he goes down to the river and he draws some water. And you can hold that image then. If you're good enough, you can hold it for a good few seconds and keep this image strong. Now imagine the boy puts down the bucket and looks up and looks to the heavens and looks at you, who's creating him the dream, and says, "I don't understand why you're so cruel to me. Well, you know, why did you make me go down the hill to get the water?" Well, the conversation doesn't really begin, right? Because you're the one who gave him the context to exist, so his question is within the context that you gave him. So, like, how do we have logic in the space where our logic is being provided by the being that's sustaining us existing in the first place? So, just like you to appreciate what Rav Lichtenstein's saying over here is God created the grid. He put you in the grid. He's telling you something which doesn't make sense within the constraints of the grid, but he put the electricity in the grid. So obviously that's the way the system's supposed to work. But the moment you start fiddling with the grid and you're saying, well, when it comes to these things, I'm going to do my own thing, that's when the problems start. And that's what Shaul was castigated for. Just like a different take on things. This is one perspective. Now, Rabbi Norman Lamb in 1970 gave a drasha in the Jewish Center, where he was rabbi for many, many strong years, and this is Shabbos Parsh Zachor, this is March 21st. His drashas are available online, by the way. So if you want to, they in the good old typewritten drashas with, as you can see over here, with his own writing. His is a very famous idea, but nonetheless, this is an important idea to reiterate because important things are important to revise. He says that this is something which is so clear, so obvious, but necessary to reconsider. Now, what I'm saying is that when compassion conflicts with other duties of man, it is not true that compassion must always, under any conditions, prevail. There's no such thing as a value which is always, always in action. There's tension, there's trade-offs. We Jews are proud of our compassionate characteristics. The rabbis refer to Israel as Rachmanim, Bnei Rachmanim, merciful ones, sons of merciful ones. But nonetheless, we do not consider it absolute and beyond modification. Rabbi Yeshua ben Nevi says, "Kol shehu rachmon al achzorim, naaseh achsol al rachmonim." You start being merciful to cruel people, you know what happens? You start being cruel to merciful people. What's the example? He says Saul, Shaul HaMelech, began by having compassion on Agag, but a few chapters later he cruelly destroys Nov, the city of priests, without even the pretext or of any moral justification. See what's he saying? When you start playing with the divine plan, and you think you're going to apply a little more of your human endowment of mercy, you end up being cruel somewhere else. And that's exactly what happened to Shaul. He spared who he shouldn't, and he killed who he should have spared. And he goes further. That is why I'm so furious to those who had pity on Eichmann and have compassion on Nazis for their advanced in their advanced Middle Ages. There was just an article a couple years ago about somebody 93 who was brought to justice. Yes, he says. He's 93. Let him spend all the rest of his years rotting in prison. Yes. He says, who had been apprehended after 25 years. A show of pity for such inhuman beasts is easily converted to inhumanity towards the innocent. Be very careful misappropriating your mercy, says Rabbi Lam. Very, very important concept. This is obvious. You know, it's the same kind of thing. The way it's sometimes described is, you enter into a child's room and you see a black widow. You see a spider of terrible poisonous capacity. And you say, oh, it's Hashem's creation. Oh, I should really, maybe I'll just put a cup over it. Or maybe I'll, you know what? You're crazy. There's a child at stake, right? You don't have mercy on a black widow. That's a poisonous spider which has the capacity to kill. You stamp it out. So Hashem says there's certain parts of my creation which need stamping out because they've shown us what their moral capacity is. Now, he says something else. This is a different argument. He actually has four arguments. We're only touching on two arguments, and very briefly. So if it doesn't sound coherent, blame it on me for not giving you the full thing. But take a look at the full text. The link is in here. But nonetheless, this is a remarkable perspective. Right? Lamb distinguishes between two types of morality. What he calls objective morality and what he calls consensual morality. So, example. Murder is that objectively immoral or consensually immoral? Objectively, you're not allowed to murder people, right? That's why it's one of the Shiva Mitzvahs Bnei Noach. It's something which HaKadosh Baruch Hu expects basic humanity to operate by. Adultery, objectively, right? These are the Shiva Mitzvahs Bnei Noach are basically stealing. These are things which are objectively abnormal. These are objectively bad, which is why, if you look at we'll call it the secular philosophers, most of them arrive at these principles without religion after a while. Right, so that they can, through critique of pure reason or through Mill, through utilitarianism, we get to the same kind of result because these are objectively immoral. However, there are things which are called, consensually immoral. So, example, it has an example, polygamy. Now, today, right, if you in America, it's illegal. Bigamy, polygamy, right? It's completely unacceptable. In Africa, by the way, just so you should know, the president of South Africa has a number of wives. And that's why a lot of good taxpayer money is going to lots of different wives. So we shouldn't think that we've mounted the hilltop of that one yet. But nonetheless, if you reverse, do we have the right to say that it is objectively immoral? Well, then what are you going to say to Yaakov Avinu? What are you going to say to Avram? What are you going to say to those people in the Torah? What are you going to say to our whole society which accept that? That means to say that there were certain things that as we developed a certain sensitivity to things and it became morally impugnant. It became something which is, and that's Rabbeinu Gershom, made a decree well over a millennia ago as to this is the way society is going to run. But that we can't now put our 2017 glasses on and then put somebody in the defense stand from a stage on something which was consensually moral at the time. So now another example he gives, slavery. He has his example. Take a look on the top of the next page in 21. It's a little faded just in this print. Another example would be slavery. Today, slavery is something which offends our deepest moral sensibilities. Yet, it is not an absolute, but a strong consensual principle. There were highly moral people of the past who never were aware of the troublesome institution of slavery. Even the Torah, which expresses itself negatively towards slavery, did not ban it completely, and Jews kept slaves well into the Middle Ages. It is not a violation of an absolute moral principle. Of course, from our contemporary perspective, we would fight to prevent the reestablishment of slavery. By the way, just look eastwards, folks. I mean, like, it's, again, we're nowhere near the top of that mountain. Look at Somalia, the slave trade in the Muslim world, folks. We have a lot of work to still be doing on humanity. But nonetheless, he says, but we have no right to condemn those in antiquity who practiced it before the consensus was achieved. In the same sense, we cannot fault George Washington or Thomas Jefferson or any other of the founders of the American Republic for being slaveholders, since they lived before the time that the whole institution was called into question on moral grounds. Again, the same point is emphasized. A moral principle, whether it is absolute or consensual, has binding force and demands that we respect it. But whether or not we can blame people of the past for its violation depends on the nature of the code. That's a very important thing. So then he goes on and he says, "Oh, so Shmuel Hanavi killing in this particular case is what he's dealing with, killing Agag. Agag was unarmed. Agag at this point in time was a prisoner of war." He said, so he goes on to describe in the next paragraph that in the end of the day, the Torah set out moral principles, and objectively, in the objective standard is that killing is not a right unless it's in self-defense or in war. Those are objective principles that have ruled humanity for all time. Now, what is war? Is war when you're fighting? Is it when they're holding a sword? When is they holding a spear? When they're holding an arrow? Or is it in the context of war as a whole? Consensually, we are now of Geneva Conventions, and we say, you know, that in certain instances when they're armed and when it's after the battle, that's no longer a problem. But who are we to redefine the boundaries of where war is and say, well, that's not allowed. No, not allowed. That's not war. And now to superimpose it backwards on Shmuel Hanavi. Right? That's the notion over here. There's an objective and there's the consensual. One should be aware of this. He goes even one step further. We're not going to deal with this, but he does point out this is a fascinating his own ha'ara, which is, why would you keep kings? Let's say you won a battle. Why would you keep kings and kill everybody else? Think of it for a second. Why would you do that? What would you try to achieve? Why would you keep a king? Surely you want to kill the king first. Why would you want to kill everybody and keep the king alive?
Shows your might.
Okay, what are you going to do to him?
Show off that you were able to.
You're going to mutilate him piece by piece. You're going to hang him up in the public square, barely alive. You're going to, have him blindfolded on wearing no clothes on a mule through the middle of town. You're going to make a terrible embarrassment of him because you're going to show your power over that person. So, you know, when we say Shaul Melech kept Agag alive, why was he keeping him alive? You know, he did have some pity, right? But when Shmuel Hanavi came to him, he says, "Achen sar mar amaves." He says, "Death is better." Why is death better? He says, "Death is better than humiliation. What's going to happen to me as being kept alive?" Shmuel might have. In this is just a fascinating twist of logic over here. What he's doing is that Shmuel was doing more of a kindness to him by killing him than putting him through what might have. He might have been kept for, if you go back to Shaul's plan. Again, that's not specifically in the text itself, that's just an interesting theory. But nonetheless, it is in Kisar Maramavis, but not more explicit in the earlier parts. But nonetheless, what Rabbi Lam is saying over here is we need to distinguish between different types of morality and which ones developed and which ones were. Okay, and this is important, and I think we sometimes conflate the two. We need to be very careful. He goes so far as to say this is just worthwhile thinking about. Conscription, you know, as an example. In 20, 30, 50 years, will conscription be moral? You know, everybody has to go and everybody has to be part of the army and, you know, okay, so I understand for protection, but maybe there'll be another system we can work out and it'll be morally disgusting that we take everybody into the army. Or let's say prison. You put somebody who's an offender and you put them for 15 years with other terrible people and you basically ruin their lives. Wouldn't it be better to, you know, like he says, like when you go look back at the Torah system where there were, he's not recommending, he's just saying when the Torah says like a system where, let's say there's flogging and the person receives immediate pain but then is let out afterwards, that creates a deterrence which isn't going to impact their whole life. So like there are certain consensual morals which we ourselves may be held accountable for in a few years' time ourselves. And so it's just fascinating to think about this. These are very good long night discussions as to, you know, how moral our society is as a whole. Nonetheless, this is another example. Now, I want to just move into two more ideas right now. We'll close with this. Rabbi Meir Soloveitchik has this incredible essay. I really recommend reading it. It's called "The Virtue of Hate." It is published on First Things. First Things is actually a Christian website, so he is a contributor there. very interesting. He has obviously got the backgrounds to be able to contribute to this. But nonetheless, a lot of interesting things he says in this website. Rabbi Meir Soloveitchik is currently the rabbi of the Spanish Portuguese Shul, and he is also the director, one of the directors for the YU's Institute for Judaism and Western Values. So he has a lot of very interesting conversations with a lot of leading figures in thought in around it. So he has an interesting point. He quotes this book called The Sunflower. Has anybody read this? Sunflower, Simon Wiesenthal. Very, very, very worth well worth reading. The Sunflower is a very hard book to read, in a certain sense, not because of the writing, but because of the concepts. He talks about that when he was going through the Holocaust, Simon Wiesenthal, of course Simon Wiesenthal is the person who hunted the Nazis after the Wiesenthal Center, trying to bring people to justice. And he talks about towards the end of his duration in the camps, he was called aside to a military hospital, and in the bed was a Nazi who was clearly dying. He was on his deathbed, and he called a Jew because he wanted to speak to a Jew. And this Nazi went through full detail about the atrocities and the hundreds of people he killed, tortured, did terrible things to. And he wanted to ask for forgiveness. He wanted a Jew to ask for forgiveness before he died for this. And he asked Simon Wiesenthal, for that. So Simon Wiesenthal actually left the room in silence. He didn't do anything. He didn't respond. And the book is essentially a question. It's a symposium, essentially, to thinkers of the world whether that was the right thing or not. Did he do the right thing by keeping silent or not? And there we have thinkers of all, it published at the back, thinkers of all denominations, religions, and creeds who contribute to whether we can, should, are able to forgive terrible, terrible people. And it's fascinating because he points out, and take a look at the end of on page 21, at the bottom over here, 5 lines from the bottom, it says, an examination of the respective replies of Christians and Jews reveals a remarkable contrast. When the first edition of The Sunflower was published, writes Dennis Prager, I was intrigued by the fact that all the Jewish respondents thought Simon Wiesenthal was right but in not forgiving the repentant Nazi mass murderer, and the Christians thought he was wrong. Isn't that interesting? Now, he goes on to say, it's not just because the Christians didn't experience the Holocaust, it's not because they didn't because of the blood, but it was because of theology. And he spends the rest of the essay showing how Jewish theology differs from Christian theology. He goes on to describe how in the end of the day, when you read through Tanakh and you read through what goes on in Tanakh, there is times where cruelty and terrible things should happen. So when Shimshon is taken and he has his eyes gouged out and he's standing between the poles, between the pillars supporting the Philistine party, when he turns to Hashem, he says, Hashem, give me nakama, give me revenge against these plishtim, al shnei al enai, on my eyes, nakama achas mishnei enai, give me one more revenge. He wasn't saying, he wasn't talking about forgiveness and bad people. He wasn't talking about the platitudes about people can be bad, but he was saying, Hashem, these are bad people. Let me be your vehicle to kill these terrible people. You go to Devorah, when Devorah sings her song about Yael killing Sisera, she goes to graphic detail about how she crushed his skull with a tent peg. When you're talking about people who are bad, really bad, monsters, right? There's no, the Judaism isn't silent about saying that there is a due meat for them at the end of the day. This is what he goes on to say. He actually quotes, one of the writers was a writer called Cynthia Ozick. Take a look at what she says here in the second paragraph on page 22. Interestingly, the most vivid response in Wiesenthal's symposium was also written by a woman. The Jewish writer Cynthia Ozick, reflecting on how Wiesenthal in a moment of mercy brushed a fly away from the Nazi's broken body, concluded her essay in Deborah's blunt but poetic manner. Let the SS man die unshriven. Let him go to hell. Sooner the fly to God than he. Meaning to say, don't mistakenly understand that Judaism is going to give mercy to bad people of such caliber who've lost their Tzelem Elokim. That's our response. Now, he goes through this and he shows why Judaism is dramatically different from Christianity in this respect. But Christianity, to a certain degree, always has a door open and people can always come back. And even if Hitler Yimach Shemo V'Zichro, well, someday, when he died, he would go to heaven in a form of something, maybe a dog. But the point is, like, no, in Judaism, there's no place. We say, we apply the words, Yimach Shemo V'Zichro. when we talk about terrible people. Let their name be erased, which means to say part of our theology is no, there is very much a place to hate. There's a place, not anybody, not all Germans, not all Arabs, but people who have done terrible things. And he goes on to, in the concluding section of the essay, he says the following. At the time, he's talking about the Oslo Accords. At the time, my grandfather, a rabbi, joined those on the Israeli right in condemning the Oslo process, arguing that it would produce a terrorist state responsible for hundreds of Israeli deaths. As a rabbinical student, I could not understand my grandfather's unremitting opposition. He was, I thought, so blinded by his hate that he was unable to comprehend the powerful potential of the peace process. How now, many hundreds of Jewish victims of suicide bombings later, and 50 years after the Holocaust, the importance and necessity of Jewish hate has once again been demonstrated. Perhaps there will soon be peace in the Middle East, perhaps not. But the one thing is certain. We will not soon forgive the actions of a man who, as he sent children to kill children, knew all too well just what he was doing. Who's he referring to? Yasser Arafat, of course. You don't make peace with a person. You don't stop hating a person who sent their children to kill our children. We cannot ask God to have mercy upon him. Those Israeli parents whose boys and girls did not come home will pray for the destiny of his soul at the conclusion of their holiest day on Yom Kippur. But their prayer will be rather different from the rosary. Let the terrorist die unshriven, let him go to hell, sooner fly to God than he. Meaning to say, there is a place, and we say Avinu Malkeinu, in the end of Avinu Malkeinu, Chatan Lufanecha, Hashem asks for forgiveness, but we say in Avinu Malkeinu as well, HaKadosh Baruch Hu, destroy our enemies. Take revenge on those people who throughout the generations brought about, spilled our blood without defense. There is a place for hate, and it's very important to understand and reckon with that. And we don't brush things under the carpet so easily. This is a very important essay. Again, I'm whitewashing it because I'm just giving you like a few snippets. It's really worthwhile reading the whole. It's 28 pages online, but you can minimize it down to a little less. But it is
26 and a half.
There you go. If you change the fonts, you should be fine. But it's worthwhile realizing that when we talked about this, let's just back up for a second. You know, in terms of dealing with Amalek, this Rav Lichtenstein talking about it, it is so because this is God's system. Or the notion of misappropriated rachmanus, or the notion of objective or consensual morality, or as we're talking about the importance of hate and the application of it. Again, these are dangerous concepts because you can see how people will misappropriate these in the name of their ideals, which they had as preconceived notions. One last idea, and I just want to leave this as for further thought. This is obviously a very heavy topic. One last thought. And that is the following, is where did Amalek come from in the first place? Meaning, like, why do we have this thorn in our sides throughout all history? Where did they come from? He was born, who is he? Who is Amalek? Amalek is? He is from Esav. He is the grandson of Esav. Where so? The Pasuk says, V'timna ha'isa pilegesh le'elifaz ben Esav, atonet le'etela le'elifaz is Amalek, ele b'nei adot eshes Esav. So he was born as a union from Eliphaz and Eliphaz and Timna. Okay, so who is this Timna? The Gemara tells us in Sanhedrin a terrifying fact. The Gemara says the following, on top of the next page. The following, just to summarize what it is that actually, Timna had once to marry into the Abrahamic dynasty, and she came. She approached Yitzchak. She approached Avraham, and Yaakov and Yitzchak, and she said, "Can I marry into this family?" And they said, "No, you cannot marry into this family." So she said, "You know what? I'd prefer to be a pilegesh to Esav or to one of the children of Esav's, rather just to be part of this dynasty." But the rejection, says the Gemara, that she had from the Abraham family was what, in the end of the day, brought about an Amalek. Meaning this child was born in bitterness. This child of Amalek was conceived in hate. Think about that for a second. What was that? Whatever reason. And by the way, probably for all the right reasons. Meaning to say, she probably had a lot of baggage. There probably was a lot about her and the values that she would bring to the table. And it's hard to us to, they're in between a rock and a hard place. But ultimately, by doing something which was probably 90%, 95%, 97% right, they still created a system of hate. And that hate bred, and that bred further, and it bred further. And we've had millions of people killed in that hate. Now, if we go another step further, where's Yishmael from? Right? Meaning, let's do the same mathematics. The where's Yishmael from? Yishmael is born to Hagar. Hagar is abused or mistreated by Sarah. Take a look at the Psukim in Psalm 13. Vatomer Sarai el Avram, Chamosi alecha anochi nosati shivchasi bechekecha vater kira harava eikel b'aneo v'yishpot Hashem b'nir v'necha. Sarah is terribly upset about the way Hagar is treating her, and probably appropriately so. Vadyomer Avram el Sarai, hinei shivchoschei iseich b'yodech, asilo achatov b'einayich, vataneo Sarah v'tibrach miponeo. And so she afflicted her, she mistreated her, she ran from her. Says the Ramban, Vataneo Sara, Vatirach Miponel, Chatoa Imenu Beoini Hazeh. She sinned in this by hurting her. Vagavrama Beanichola Soska came, and Avram, by being a passive observer, Vishama Shem is Nio, Vnosan Lo, Ben, Shehe Pere Odom, La Nois Zera Avraham Vesara, Bechol Mineha Oni. And from that union came a child who would in fact repay that pain. And we're still repaying that pain today. Take a look at this. The next quote, this is Rav Shmuel Moliva, one of the predominant Zionist, religious Zionists. In the later days, it was Rav Shmuel Moliva, the Rabbi Bialystok, one of the great leaders of the Chivas Tzion movement, who made a similar comment when the Turkish government was about to banish from the Jewish settlements those Russian Jews who had moved to the country but not taken Ottoman citizenship. He cried out and said, it is because of the drive out this handmaiden, Hagar and her son, that the Muslims, the children of Yishmael, the son of Hagar, will now cast out Sarah from Ireland. You know, and so what he's saying is, and again, it's not something which is we can really fairly change. You know, and even if you're to speak to the characters involved at the time, they were doing the right thing on the whole, with like small adjustments. But at the end of the day, we bear that as well. So this is not blaming the Holocaust and the Jews, Chas v'Shalom. Okay? Well, what this is saying is that when we look into history and we know that there is such a tarnish on humanity, we should also reckon with making sure that there are no more tarnishes. Making sure that there's no people that we also reject who create, who beget such evil, such hate as well. So as opposed to sort of sitting here in the shir and like arrogantly looking outwards as well, we also need to look inwards and think as well to ourselves, how many times in the way that we act and coordinate and react in life are we in the same driving shoes as Avram and Sarah, Yitzhak and Rivka, and making sure that we correct what could be otherwise. Anyways, I hope this is food for thought. I know this is a very tense topic. Lots more to discuss. I'd be very happy to have any discussions on it. Thank you, ladies.